We're going to take up our story again today in Genesis chapter 25 with the story of Yitzhak and Rebekah, and then the birth of their sons, whose stories will take up pretty much the rest of the book of Genesis. This is what it says in Genesis 25:19. These are the generations of Yitzhak, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Yitzhak, and Yitzhak was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean. And so this is one of those Toledoth passages, and it zeroes us in on the line of the promised son, Yitzhak, and how when they got married, they couldn't yet get pregnant. Yitzhak was 40, and I'm guessing that Rebekah was somewhere beneath that in age, maybe in her 20s, possibly in her 30s. And they tried to have children for roughly 20 years. So they get married in 2036, and by the time 2016 is almost there, they still can't have a child. And so they feel that same pressure that Abraham and Sarah felt whenever they could not have children together. So Yitzhak does what I think he was probably taught to do, and that is talk to God about it. And keep in mind that even though we've already talked about the death of Abraham, he is still very much alive at the time of this story here. He will not pass away from the scene until the twins that are going to be born are about 15 years of age. So verse 21, Genesis 25, Yitzhak prayed to He Who Is for his wife because she was barren. And then He Who Is granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So now we're having children of promise again. It's happening because God is intervening. Verse 22, the children struggled together within her. And she said, "It is thus. Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of He Who Is. So she's got this wrestling match going on inside of her. And some of you ladies that have had children, sometimes if you've had twins, you know that when they're very, very active, it makes you very uncomfortable and you wonder what's happening. Well, that's where she's at. And so she goes to ask God about it. Now, I'm a little bit intrigued by this because there are several potential places she could have gone. It does not appear that she goes to her husband, even though her husband had been praying on her behalf. I think it's possible she might have gone to her father-in-law, Abraham, because he is a prophet. We know that from several occasions in the story, that he's called that. So maybe she went and asked him, "Could you ask God what this is all about?" Or one other possibility, did she perhaps go up to Salem, the ancient city where Jerusalem will eventually be located, where Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High, might have still been alive and ministering? Because we know that he was a prophet functioning in the land whenever Abraham arrived, and he could certainly have been a source of information. So we don't know who she went and used to make this inquiry, but we do know she wanted to know from the God Who Is, what's going on with my children, the children that you've given to me as a gift. Verse 23, so He Who Is said to her, two nations are in your womb. So two people groups, two peoples from within you shall be divided. And the one will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. Now, that's a very relative term here when we're talking about twins. They're born within minutes of one another. So the older of the two is going to end up becoming junior to the younger one. And this is a prophecy that tells the story ahead of time of the preeminency of the Israelite line, the Jacob line. And that will become obvious as we go on with the story here. So the first people reading the book of Genesis are descendants of Jacob, whose birth is about to take place here. And so they would appreciate quite well seeing their ancestor in this story and understanding that he was going to be given a special position by God, a position that they were now benefiting from. Verse 24. When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, and all his body like a hairy cloak. And so they named him, or called his name, Esau. Now, Esau is a very interesting name in Hebrew. I think the best way to bring it into English is piece of work. So he was a piece of work, kind of like a nice blanket or a rug that's been woven very, very well. So he comes out just covered in hair, and it's red hair. And then baby number two, born very briefly thereafter, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so that his name was called Yaakov, which means heel grabber. And Yitzhak was 60 years old when she bore them. So they each get a name that has something to do with them at their birth. Esau is a great piece of work, just like a nice red furry rug. And Yitzhak comes out holding onto his brother's heel, and so he's called Heel Grabber. Now, I am not certain which is derived from which. Whether or not Heel Grabber applied to Jacob takes on a secondary meaning of somebody that tries to fool you because of what Jacob, the original heel grabber, did, or whether that was already a saying. Oh, you're pulling my leg. You're pulling my heel. You're messing with me. My thinking is that it's very likely something that already existed, that it was an idiom from long, long before this, and that Jacob is just going to simply live up to his name of being a leg puller. Verse 27. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. So Esau expresses this temperament for liking to be outside. He likes to be out in the wilds. He likes to go hunting, tracking down game, shooting it, skinning it out, bringing it back, you know, and cooking it up and probably tanning the hide and things like that. So he's a rugged outdoors type of guy. His brother, though, is not like that. They don't seem to be identical twins. They seem to be slightly different in their genetic makeup, as well as in their temperaments. Jacob is more of a homebody. He likes to hang with mom and see how the whole tent encampment is run. While Jacob is out there, Esau is out there maybe working with dad and maybe going hunting with dad. Esau was loved by Yitzhak because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, there shouldn't be this sort of favoritism within a family, but sometimes it does happen because of temperaments. Isaac loved to eat wild game and may have enjoyed the hunt just as much as his son Esau did. And so they bond over this. While Rebecca, who is running all of the operations of the tent city, she enjoys having her son Jacob around, helping with things like that and learning how to run all the different aspects of a huge encampment such as they have. And so she develops a bond with him. And so each parent has their own child they tend to relate to. And that is going to feed into the problem that comes in a bit that drives a wedge between these two young men. Now, we do not know where in the timeline this next story happens. I suspect that it is after Abraham is dead. That Yitzhak is now the head of the tent encampment, tent city, and he's running all the day-to-day operations along with his wife, Rebecca. So Abraham is a passing memory. But the two boys, the two twins, would have been 15 years old when Grandpa Abraham died. And so I want you to know they did have some sort of interaction with him. So verse 29 gets in now to the big problem that starts between the two. It says, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. So we've already learned Jacob likes to be the homebody, stick around the home encampment. He's learning how to, you know, cook and take care of things of that sort. Esau likes to go out hunting. But you understand, you don't always come back with game every time you go out. Sometimes you have an off day or even an off season. So Esau's been at hunting all day long, and he comes back empty-handed, and he is famished. He is very, very hungry. And so Esau said to Yaakov, to Jacob, let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted. And therefore his name was called Edom. Now, Edom in Hebrew means red. And we've got several reasons why Esau takes on this name. He was first of all born with a lot of red hair over his body, and so it's not altogether uncommon for red-haired, hairy men to be called Red. Hey, Red, how you doing? But also, this stew is red, and he's about to sell his birthright in order to eat some of this red stuff. And so Moses says this is another reason why he got called Red, is because of this particular incident. So Jacob said, sell me your birthright now. I doubt that this is the first time that the birthright conversation has come up between the two of them. Esau does not seem to be all that interested in running the tent encampment once his father is dead, which is the norm. The eldest son takes on the role of the father of the encampment. And that doesn't seem to be Esau's cup of tea. He prefers to go out and hunt whenever he feels like and not worry about all this stuff. But Jacob, you know, he's been hanging around. He works with his mom all the time about the encampment. So he knows things inside out on what it takes to run such a massive operation like this. more than likely he has to take care of the close-in flocks and herds and the pack animals. He has to probably make sure that the different families that work for them are taken well care of. So he's more interested in wanting to be in charge once their father is dead. So if he's aware, as I suspect he is, that his big brother is not all that interested in it, why not get him to agree to giving it up? So Jacob says, hey, you want some red stuff? I'll sell you some red stuff. Let me have your birthright. And so Esau said back to him, I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me? And so Jacob said, swear it to me now. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and he drank and he rose and he went his way. And thus Esau despised his birthright. And so this is where we get that understanding that is brought up in the New Testament, that Esau was not interested in the birthright until much later in his life. And then it was too late because he'd given it up. And he was sorry over having given it up. And no matter how much he cried and begged and pleaded, it was a done deal. It had already passed over. Now, this is the first time it passes over. And this should be considered pretty legal, because the two brothers agreed on the transfer of the birthright. But later in the story, Esau seems to have either forgotten or maybe considered this all a big joke and was planning on receiving his father's blessing, including this birthright transfer, to make him the head of the encampment. And that will be when Mom steps in to help Jacob get the birthright by tricking Yitzhak. And it's not a good story, and we'll get to it in a little bit. But first, we got to let some time pass. Let these two young men get much older. And by the way, they will get considerably older. Esau is going to get married when he's in his 30s, going into his 40s, while Jacob will remain unmarried up into his 70s. And that might seem shocking to us, but that's because we're not thinking on the time scale of their lifespans. They will all live into their second century, and therefore delaying until he's in his 70s to get married would be roughly equivalent to Jacob staying unmarried into, say, his early 30s or his mid-30s today for people living an average lifespan into the 70s. Okay? But first, let's have another story about how Yitzhak apparently heard stories from Mom and Dad, which he then put into practice in his own life, and it causes trouble. So chapter 26, verse 1, there was a famine in the land, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham, and Yitzhak went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. Now, I'm of the opinion this is not likely to be the same Abimelech from the Abraham story. I think that the term Abimelech is probably a title, kind of like Pharaoh. And so this is perhaps the son or the grandson of the guy that Abraham had interaction with. Gerar is likely to be a reference to a city that's on the watershed that drains into the Mediterranean Sea right around Gaza City today. We know that Beersheba is on the upper reaches of this watershed. And so as the famine takes hold at places like Beersheba and Beer Lahairoi, the water table drops, and Yitzhak has to go elsewhere to water and forage his animals. And so your best choice is to go downstream, downslope, toward the Mediterranean, because the water table will have not dropped as far below the surface in places like that. So he goes down to Gerar city, and verse 2, he who is appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell you. So he apparently toyed with the idea of going to Egypt, like Abraham did, but God said, don't you do it. You stay in Canaan. Verse 3, sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you, for to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands, and in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So we have a repeat there of the Abrahamic blessing. First, the number being very large of his descendants, the giving of the promised land to these descendants of this particular promised line, and then ultimately the messianic promise, which they don't understand yet, but which we do because we got 20/20 hindsight. We've got Paul telling us about it in Galatians chapter 3, that the Messiah, HaMashiach, is going to come out of this particular Isaac line, and everybody's going to get blessed because of salvation. Verse 5, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So Yitzhak settled in Gerar. And when the men of the place asked him about his wife, who is apparently very beautiful, he said, she's my sister. For he feared to say my wife, thinking lest the men of this place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. So once again, we understand the thinking process here. If he can pass himself off as the older brother of Rebekah, then he kind of controls access to his single sister to suitors. And suitors are going to try to be nice to him and bend over backwards because they all hope that they'll be the successful suitor that will get married to her. But his worry is, if they know that she's my wife, then what's to stop them from murdering me and just taking her? And so he assumes evil intentions on behalf of these people, which is probably not appropriate, thinking the worst. So he engages in an absolute full lie. He and Rebekah are cousins, but they are not siblings. And most certainly he intended to deceive, so not good. When he had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and saw Yitzhak laughing with Rebekah, his wife. Now, that's our English Standard Version. I think the New American Standard and others get it right, that it was more intimate than that. The word literally means playing. And so they were apparently having a little bit of a sex romp. Some sort of intimate touching that was going on. They thought they were not being seen by anyone, but Abimelech might have had a higher building view of the encampment, and he was taken aback by this, because that's not the way brothers and sisters act. So verse number 9, Abimelech called Yitzhak and said, behold, she's your wife. So she's got to be your wife, man. There's no way in the world you should be touching your sister like that. So how could you say she is my sister? And Yitzhak said to him, well, it's because I thought lest I die because of her. And Abimelech said, what is this you've done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and then you would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. I wonder whether or not some little stories had come down through the Abimelech line about the earlier problems when the previous Abimelech apparently had some sort of physical problem that was assigned to him and the people in his kingdom for as long as he had Sarah as a potential mate. So maybe this Abimelech is aware of all that and says, we are not having any of that around here. So we're going to get this problem fixed, and we're going to get it fixed now. And so verse 12 reports that Yitzhak sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold. And he who is blessed him, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy. And he had possessions and flocks and herds and many servants, so that the Philistines envied him. So God blesses him in the midst of all this, not because of his lies, but in spite of them. Have a great weekend. We'll come back to this story next time we're in the Word.